This nation was founded on the principle that all men are created equal.
We hold these truths to be self-evident.
That all men are created equal.
I'll tell you what freedom is to me. No fear. I mean, really, no fear.
Created equal.
This is Created Equal from 101.9 WDET, Detroit's public radio station. I'm your host, Stephen Henderson, and I'm really glad you've joined. When you think about firsts in this nation, a number of different things could come to mind. First principles, like the things that we read and learned about in the Declaration of Independence or the U.S. Constitution. But you can also think about first peoples and how the first people who were here, not Europeans, not Africans, but Native Americans, who over centuries built a complex and sweeping civilization that greeted Europeans when they came here first. When you think about the way they interact with the history of the United States, what do you think of? It's really a conflict of firsts, a nation trying to establish itself, trying to build customs and rules and traditions that would be different from what they were fleeing in Europe. And first peoples who had to have been absolutely confused and puzzled by the presence of these new people, but then were absolutely savaged by them, swindled out of land, introduced to diseases they hadn't known, and eventually removed from the civilization they built. In a new book, Professor Ned Blackhawk of Yale University talks about this history in a really different and engaging way. He says we have it all wrong when we think about that conflict of firsts, that it's, yes, a battle of two different civilizations, but it becomes a struggle of one, a struggle of a nation that includes both the Europeans who came here and the people who were here already. And then over 2.5 centuries, those native people have a profound influence over the nation that gets built in ways that most of us, in the things we learned in school or in college, just would never know. We don't talk about it. We don't think about it. We don't see them in the way we see other parts of our history. Today on Created Equal, we're going to talk with Professor Blackhawk not just about his work in the book, but about what this work means to him. He is Native American, part of the civilization that was here before the United States and that has had such a profound influence over it. I'm really excited to talk to Ned because I've known him for an awful long time. He and I grew up in the city of Detroit together and went to high school together. And I have to admit, I never really thought about what it meant to him to be Native American, what it felt like to him to sit through history classes in our high school and either not hear at all about his own history or hear things that were absolutely false or ridiculous. I'm here with Carrie Jr. II, who is the producer of Created Equal. Carrie, welcome to the studio.
How you doing, Stephen?
And I'm really looking forward to this conversation with Ned Blackhawk. Now, we should say also up front, Carrie, you're also a graduate of the high school that Ned Blackhawk and I went to. You're a little younger than we are, so you were there more recently. But the absence of this story, the lack of context and information about the relationship between Native peoples and the United States, well, that's a continuum through our high school curriculum. That's what we experienced in the 1980s. It's what you experienced much later, too.
Yeah, it's what I experienced. Do you want me to say the year, Stephen? I don't know if that...
I don't know if we need to be so specific about that.
I wasn't going to give all of that information, but it's a similar experience to mine. When I learned history, you get a snapshot in a brief moment in time where our settlers interact with Native Americans. But largely after that, one, you don't know the significance of that engagement and how that influences America's founding. And then you don't know beyond that what the life of Native Americans are as, you know, America comes to as America evolves into the country that we know it is today. We've kind of largely forgotten about in our country's story.
Yeah, yeah. And as I said earlier, Ned is Native American. And mm-hmm. so for him, one of the things I'm really interested in hearing mm-hmm. in this interview is how that felt to right. sit in class and move through academia in a much more sophisticated way and not see yourself. Now, of course, you and I are African Americans. We have similar experiences, right? I mean, mm-hmm. Black history, the things that brought Africans here, the story of how we went from slavery to segregation to more freedom than we had before, that doesn't get told in any sort of complete or sophisticated way in most classes either.
Yeah.
But I think a key difference for Native Americans, and this is something I really want to get to with Ned in the interview, is that this is their home, right? They weren't, right. they're not visitors, or they didn't arrive here to have to find an American experience. Their American experience starts centuries before any of the rest of us were here. And so I think to see yourself erased in the way that school curricula do for Native peoples, it's got to feel different than mm-hmm. it does for everybody else.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, too, it seems like nowadays we're starting to catch up and understand how much we've been missing from those narratives. And it's unfortunate because not that we've completely corrected what we've gotten wrong about our history, Black history. We've gone from Black History Month to now people are trying to celebrate it all the time. And there's other conversations outside of how that history is going politically. But now we're getting to the Native American story. And I think it's great that we're getting to that place. And maybe I'm presumptuous here. Maybe we aren't. Maybe it's just you and I in this show that is starting to unravel a little bit deeper what that looks like. But for me, it was profound when you brought up wanting to talk to Professor Blackhawk, how little I was aware we haven't been really unpacking this, right? So we talk about Black history and we're still fighting for that, and yet we haven't even acknowledged the story. I'm not even the atrocities that happened, just the story of the people who were living in this country before Europeans arrived and as the country was founded. So I'm excited to talk about that. Yeah. I think when you talk about his particular experience too, I'm wondering how that motivated him to pursue the path that he has pursued now to become a professor in history. I also am interested to really hear about kind of the particular interactions that the Native Americans had with the Europeans and how, you know, creating a new country within a land that already exists.
Mm-hmm.
Starting anything new is complicated because you don't know really how to do it yet. And so hearing kind of the stories and the narratives of what it's like to decide on what the laws are, who's gonna abide by these laws, who do we have jurisdiction over, is fascinating.
Yeah. One of the things that I think is really clear about Ned's work is the certainty with which he's written this book.
Mm-hmm.
The title,
yeah,
The Rediscovery of America, Native Peoples and the Unmaking of U.S. History.
Yeah.
It's such an ambitious idea, right? He's saying, look, we're not just finding this kind of new space to think about these things, but what it represents is a tearing down in some ways of what we know, and a remaking, it sort of points to a remaking of the idea of what history is. I mean, such an incredible way to kind of frame all of the work that he did and the story that he wants to tell. And of course, it's being told by a Detroiter. I mean, it's being told by somebody whose experiences look like those of us who grew up here. And so there's a lot in the book that I think signals the basis that he has here, that foundation, that Detroit, of course, plays a huge role in the story of Native peoples and how they related to first the French and then the English who came here, but also how over time that story gets lost, that story gets buried. It's such an ambitious piece of work, and again, it is a gesture toward a rethinking that I think is long overdue. So let's get to it with Professor Ned Blackhawk from Yale University. Ned, it's really great to have you back here in Detroit and on Created Equal. Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
So I want to start here. As I said, this is an area that I consider kind of a blind spot for me. You grew up here in the city of Detroit. We actually happened to be classmates at the University of Detroit Jesuit High School. You were a year behind me, but we were both members of the marching band at the school. I can remember sitting through classes there, though, for many years, and almost never coming across the kind of material that you have here in your book, the history of the relationship between the settlers here and the people who were here before them. That ignorance, I think, really frames a lot of the trouble that we have making sense of that relationship today. So I want to start with you talking about the importance of that understanding, why we all need to know more about Native people here and the relationship that exists, that complex, awful relationship in some ways that exists between Native peoples and the folks who came to create the United States.
Well, it is a common experience that you experienced, that I also experienced in school, that I'm sure most, if not all, of your listeners have experienced, and that is the woeful attention that American public schools and advanced academic institutions, universities, have generally given or not given to the subject. It's ironic because these are the oldest human communities in North America. They predate European arrival by centuries, if not millennia, and comprise a kind of fundamental kind of mortar or foundation for understanding American history more broadly. So it took a long time, and it's very kind of personal as well as intellectual experience that I had. But at some point as a young adult, I decided that I would dedicate myself to these subjects and kind of tumbled down the academic rabbit hole into a world of other works and scholars and research initiatives that ultimately brought me to the recognition that a book of this scale really needed to be done, because very few universities or high school educators have access to kind of single volume works that bring some of these themes into focus. And the title, The Rediscovery of America, really is a gesture to a now generation or so of scholars who have been working to really refashion those understandings of American history to be more inclusive and conscious of these earlier human and so ongoing human dynamics.
Yeah. So I do want to come back to that personal journey that you referenced there in the, your first answer to becoming this this vessel for information and storytelling about Native peoples that so many of us just never got when we were growing up. But we'll do that in the second segment of the interview today. But before we do that, I want to focus on a specific phrase here. In the title of your book, it also says that you're writing about the unmaking of U.S. history. And I think that's such a powerful phrase. It implies that you're trying to go beyond filling knowledge gaps. You're trying to correct something. You're trying to take something apart and put it back together. I wonder if you can talk more about that approach.
I'm happy to. And the title, The Rediscovery, is a kind of gesture towards these hundreds, if not thousands, of academics and tribal community researchers and others who've made this subject legible for really the first time in a kind of vast national sense. But we're all working also up against really entrenched paradigms of understanding, or what I like to refer to as calcified forms of received wisdom, that make it hard to break through certain kind of formations, intellectual, academic, various what we might call even subfield paradigms of American history. So if our vision of American history is rooted in certain temporalities like the 19th century, or if it's rooted in certain subject matters like the antebellum era, if we think of American history as it often has been taught as beginning with Puritans, patriots, and presidents, we lose the capacity to see beyond those categories. So we have to unmake some of these familiar received categories of analysis in order to see longer subject matters over time. So that's the kind of gesture towards an attempt to not just add additional subject matters to an already crowded landscape of historical subjects, but to try to refashion them into a larger or more inclusive mosaic.
Yeah. And one of the periods, or I guess the institutions that you focus on in the book that you think we need to unmake and kind of rethink, is the creation of the nation itself. After the Revolutionary War, delegates gather in Philadelphia in the summer of 1789 in order to fashion a new nation, and they come out with the U.S. Constitution, which then goes on to be presented to the different states for ratification, and the United States kind of starts at that point. In the book, you talk about the undiscovered, really, role, or unnoted role, that Native peoples played in that part of the process, in the formation of the Constitution. And that I think it goes a long way to suggesting that we're thinking about it all wrong, that we're missing a crucial piece of where this country actually even comes from by not even acknowledging or knowing what that role was.
Yes, you're referencing to Chapter 6, which is on the Constitution. The book is divided into two halves. The first half is what we would think of as more conventional U.S. colonial history, and the second half is more post-constitutional or post-independence 19th and 20th century U.S. history. And it's really perhaps going to be surprising to your audience members to hear this, but the Great Old Northwest, as it was called, I refer to it as the Native Inland Sea after an Ojibwe poet who fashions a poem in 1837 up in Mackinac about the region. This world has far more influence upon the shaping of the Revolution and the Constitution and thus the Republic than we've ever been taught. Detroit, as we know, is founded in 1701. We don't really understand why 1701 matters. We know that some French fur traders are coming down and the Cadillacs is building a Pontchartrain and so forth. But that French colonial history is part of a much larger continental-wide transformation that's occurring following European arrival and settlement. And that ends chapter three in the book, this kind of great monumental peace that is established between the French and their various Indian allies, as well as enemies, most notably the Iroquois Confederacy in 1701. And that settlement, which is held in Montreal in the summer of 1701, essentially sets a limit for Iroquois expansion west of what is called Iroquois or known as Iroquois. And so the French are essentially building forts across the Great Lakes after this settlement that they know can be secured from these Indian raiders or antagonists. And so Detroit's history is inherently rooted in that multilateral world of indigenous, both allies and antagonists and French settlers. And it's not surprising that over its first century of history, small but nonetheless important fort and settlement there are still part of this kind of revolutionary society that is forming to its east. The last actually French fort to surrender formally is in Detroit in December of 1760. There are 1,000 people gathered when the French formally abdicate their control and the British arrive. We may know that Pontiac's uprising occurs in Detroit shortly thereafter in 1763, and that he and his allies lay siege to the now English settlement that's there. But we've lost sight of the fact that this type of struggle for sovereignty is occurring all across the former French Empire, all across the Upper Ohio River, in places that are now familiar to us, but we, again, don't really know their larger history, places like Pittsburgh or what was then Duquesne, Detroit, Quebec and Montreal. They're all undergoing these rapid Michilimackinac, you know, they're all undergoing rapid political transformations. And the British are trying to essentially govern this former world of the French Empire that they've inherited, and they're failing. And they ultimately lose it to their former settlers or their former subjects, who then form their own union. So the United States is formed out of a struggle for access and control over much of the interior world. And so when the Constitution is constituted and then ratified, it has all these provisions around the incorporation of new lands and the place of Native peoples within it. And so we've been kind of taught only part of these subject matters or histories. We've been taught about those who wrote the Declaration, those who wrote and signed and ratified the Constitution, but not about the kind of myriad of peoples who also inhabited not just North America, but portions of the evolving United States at the time.
Okay, we're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we will continue this conversation with Professor Ned Blackhawk, author of The Rediscovery of America, Native Peoples, and the Unmaking of U.S. History. Stay tuned. We'll have more Created Equal for you in just a minute. We're back with Created Equal from WDET in Detroit. I'm your host, Stephen Henderson, and I'm really glad you've joined us. Our guest today is Ned Blackhawk. He is a professor of history at Yale University and the author of a book titled The Rediscovery of America, Native Peoples, and the Unmaking of U.S. History. That book was chosen for the National Book Award at the end of 2023. Ned, as I said earlier in the show, you're a native Detroiter, in addition to being a member of a Native nation here in the United States. And you and I share a common high school, a common education of sorts. And I started the interview by talking about the gaps in that education, the things that we weren't exposed to at University of Detroit Jesuit High School here in Detroit, the things about Native peoples that just weren't part of the curriculum. For me, that led to what I have to admit to is an ignorance about that history. But I've thought since discovering your book and learning more about your career, that that must have looked and felt really different for you, someone who has a connection, a biological connection to Native peoples here in the United States. And so I do wonder what effect that had on you and how that plays into the decisions you make later in life to become a scholar of history and to write a book like The Rediscovery of America, which really, again, calls for a rethink of our history in a way that accounts more for the Native story.
You know, I think we both grew up on the west side of Detroit. I grew up over near 6 Mile in the Southfield Freeway. Our first home was over right off Greenfield and Fenkel.
Mm-hmm.
5 Mile for those who understand. So I spent my entire first 18 years of my life on Detroit's west side. I went to Cook Elementary and then regional public school before going to U of D, where we met. And so I'm very familiar with the kind of misunderstandings that people have about Native Americans, especially people in Detroit. Not mm-hmm. that Detroit is unique in that regard. But in some strange way, I spent a portion of my career teaching at the University of Wisconsin in Madison, where there are 11 federally recognized tribes that are far more visible than the tribes in Michigan are.
Mm.
And so in certain parts of the Midwest, in Wisconsin and Minnesota, I also lived in Canada where I went to college. Indigenous peoples are more visible in the kind of everyday political and social and now economic life of these regions. But that wasn't the case in Detroit so much, particularly in the 80s, when a series of national policies kind of started eroding attempts from the 70s to try to restore and support various Native political and economic initiatives.
Mm-hmm.
I write about that actually in the end of the book. And so it's kind of an interesting subject matter because now with gaming and other kind of exertions of tribal sovereignty, tribal nations are much more visible in the upper Midwest than they were when we were growing up. So it could be that I'm a single child, that I didn't have real peers to kind of who were going through a similar experience. I also have an Indian last name. My mom, as you know, is a non-Indian, former Detroit school teacher. Mm-hmm. My dad is from Nevada, where our tribe and family are from. I am an enrolled member there, though I never lived there until I was an adult. So I have this kind of very unique biography and background. But it's actually very common for American Indians of my generation, in part because these were the policies of the federal government throughout the post-war era of the 60s and 70s to forcibly either terminate tribal communities and or relocate their community members to urban environments. Detroit was not a big relocation center compared to a place like Chicago or mm-hmm. Cleveland, but there are still thousands of urban Indians across the Detroit area. Some of whom I grew up in and around, given my dad's interest in these subjects. So my experience as an urban Indian is not that unusual, but it did breed a lot of uncertainty and a sense of kind of difference that took me a while to manage. And so you can probably imagine the types of things young children say to each other on the playgrounds of Detroit or in the schoolyards or in the classroom and so forth. It wasn't perhaps the kindest world, but in a certain sense, I really value the experience in life I've had. I had in Detroit growing up because there was at the time and still today a real deep commitment to integration, in certain forms. Mm-hmm. And so it wasn't as if in our neighborhood we were the only non-white family. There were plenty of people of color over in our neighborhood, and people from all over the world, really, a lot of people, Lebanese grocers and Chaldean party store owners and, you know, Korean cleaners and or people who ran businesses from all kinds of backgrounds and walks of life. And so there was a kind of heterogeneity and diversity that wasn't perhaps as pernicious as one might find elsewhere.
And at what point does it come to you that, hey, not only do I have this inherent human and biological connection to this, but I have an intellectual curiosity about it and the desire to kind of correct what's going wrong with the storytelling here, that that so much of our nation doesn't ever get exposed to the story of Native peoples and their interrelations with Europeans who come here. At what point for you does that become it has become the central part of your work. Where does that motivation come from?
Well, I think two things kind of happened to me around the same time. When I was in college in Canada in the late 80s and early 90s, I found myself unaware of the pre-existing kind of political activities that were percolating across the region. So it's somewhat of a long story, but I did end up choosing to go to school in Quebec rather than Ann Arbor. And so rather than meeting classmates or perhaps a dorm member, you know, rather than living in Ann Arbor in the late 80s, I moved to Canada where I knew no one and found myself living literally within a French Canadian town, attending an Anglophone school at a time when Mohawk Indians outside of the city were taking over bridges and contesting the kind of encroachment of municipalities onto their reserve lands. This is known as the Oka Crisis of 1990. Mm-hmm. And it brought to my attention the political reality of Native peoples there in a way that I'd never seen in my life before. I knew about like my own tribe struggles with the federal government and various things of that nature. But I'd never seen, defiant and militant and kind of empowered indigenous activism of any kind of this form. I'd seen, you know, movies or read books or something. But so it really imprinted itself upon me. And I'll be honest and kind of share that it's put me on a path to self-reflection where I started realizing that this part of my life, which I, you know, always knew about, I wish I had more knowledge of. And so I decided that I would, reach out to my dad's siblings. And I moved from Canada out west and, became essentially someone whose life was both intellectually and personally committed to this subject.
Wow. I mean, that's such a familiar tale. I think many African Americans find that same moment in life where you start to ask questions about, hey, where am I from? Where are my people from? And how did we get here? And what is the history that, you know, again, we weren't necessarily taught in school about all of that. And so you see lots of people going, for instance, from Detroit back to southern states, right? My own family. I've gone back to Natchez, Mississippi, which is where my dad is from, to learn much more about where we come from and what the history was that brought us to this place. For Native peoples, I think one of the differences is that that the history there is perhaps even more obscure and more buried, right? The things that you're writing about in your book, The Rediscovery of America, many of them are ideas of first impression for me. I mean, things I just never have heard of. And I can't think of, even in the African-American context, the same kind of things that would just never have even been thought of. Was there in this journey a difficulty in exploring all of these things to the extent that you did? And also, was there resistance that you met, I guess, along the way in the academy, right? Thinking about higher ed in particular and how unrepresented Native peoples and Native peoples' ideas are there. I wonder what that journey might have looked like for you.
The short answer is yes and yes. It was a process of personal challenge and academic resistance, in part because there were so few peers and role models or mentors. And so I did bounce between graduate programs, in part because of these resistances. Mm. I essentially found myself in a secure place academically, but it was not in the elite pantheon of academic institutional settings. And so to get the kind of education I really needed in the mentorship required me to go to a Pac-12 school in the state of Washington at the University of Washington, which is a great university and had a great mentor, but it was just far afield from the centers of academic authority at, sure, say, Berkeley, Ann Arbor, Chicago, or Ivy League-y places. So I never anticipated ending up in these places because of those early years of being lost in a new universe. But over time, I and many others became part of this generation that has rediscovered American history. And there's a kind of growing movement to reform these often inadequate paradigms.
Yeah. Yeah. And so now you're at Yale University, of course, an Ivy League university by any measure, prestigious. You're a history professor there. I wonder, are you the only Native American who is in the history department at Yale? I mean, is it that isolating, or have we made more progress than that?
I am the only one in the history department at the time. There have been a few other faculty during my time here, and we now have three Native American and or Indigenous faculty teaching on campus. I don't feel that isolated because three is a lot more than one. And many of these Ivy League schools are a lot smaller than Big Ten schools like Michigan or Ohio State. So, sure. We're not large in numbers, but we have we're large in spirit, perhaps.
Yeah. And do you still find resistance to the work? This book has met with all kinds of critical acclaim outside of the academy, and of course you won the National Book Award for it. But inside places like Yale, is there still the need on your part, do you feel, for the kind of vigilance to make the case, to make the argument that this is an important story, we've got to keep telling it, we've got to keep exploring it?
You know, I was the first tenured Native American faculty member appointed here in 2008-09. That gave me a lot of standing that I have kind of tried to inhabit. So I don't feel the resistance so much on campus as I do across the profession, because many of my peers, institutional settings like Stanford or until recently Harvard, didn't have faculty at all. Mm. So without faculty, this field doesn't really exist, and it doesn't provide students the kind of mentorship or support, let alone reach into publishing or kind of textbook type of worlds. So I'm actually very, kind of satisfied or kind of extremely humbled by the recognition that this book is getting. There have been a few kind of concerned reviews from the early American historians who think some of what I'm doing isn't that new. But it's not a book of research findings in the same way, as it's more of a synthetic interpretive overview that is doing the type of things that I think you're recognizing.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, we're going to take another quick break. And when we come back, we're going to talk with Ned Blackhawk of Yale University about where the story of Native peoples and the United States stands now, and the things we need to be doing to repair some of the inequalities that still linger from centuries of negative interaction. Stay where you are. We'll be back with more Created Equal. This is Created Equal from WDET-FM in Detroit. I'm Stephen Henderson, and thanks for joining. Our guest is Ned Blackhawk, professor of history at Yale University and the author of a book titled The Rediscovery of America, Native Peoples, and the Unmaking of U.S. History. Ned, I always want to have this conversation with historians. And so I've got you here, and I'm going to have it with you. This is an incredible treatise on a huge swath of our history. But it's 2024, and we still have, I think, incredible examples of the way in which the inequality that was imposed on Native peoples from the beginning still visits with us today. So I want to give you a chance to take your work, the things that we learn in this book, and apply them to the things that we see today, and talk about the things that we need to do, the things we need to pay attention to correct those.
You know, working on this book created a set of opportunities that I tried to take advantage of, one of which was to create maps in both the front and end papers that show, particularly at the end, the kind of contemporary landscape of indigenous communities across the contiguous United States. Mm-hmm. We may all hear that the federal government recognizes over 560 Native nations in the United States, but we may not realize that many of them are not that far from where we reside. And so Michigan's approximately a dozen tribal communities appear on this map. The 11 or 12 that I referenced from Wisconsin are there. There are, you know, hundreds of tribes in place collectively in California, Oklahoma, New Mexico, Arizona, and the state of Washington kind of combined. So knowing the geography of America will help us understand its history. And more broadly, knowing the history will help us understand perhaps some of our future. Native Americans struggle to get their distinctive legal and political authority kind of recognized, and we're kind of stuck within an often kind of rights-based frame of civil kind of rights era legacies that are often being used against tribal communities. So the 14th Amendment has kind of become a vehicle for trying to diminish collective tribal authority over individual kind of community members who's over issues of like child welfare and kind of certain kind of adoption prerogatives. That was in a Supreme Court case last summer called Holland versus Burkeen, which thankfully upheld the kind of constitutionality of a civil rights era law to protect tribal children from their removal into non-Indian homes and foster agencies. But there was still a kind of latent opinion within the ruling that brought back this kind of question of whether or not tribal distinctiveness essentially can survive within a kind of pluralistic American legal community, where individual rights seemingly are the most important form of legal protection. So there are a lot of challenges towards educating people about what treaties are, what reservation jurisdiction means, what tribal citizenship does and doesn't mean. I'm a tribal member. My tribe's in Nevada. But I don't get, you know, monthly payments from anybody. I, you know, my life is not immeasurably kind of made kind of easier. In fact, that's quite the opposite. So, you know, to be from a tribal community, like being from other kind of subordinated and or racialized communities, is not necessarily easy. But we can't flatten that experience and conflate it with others. So I don't know if that's a real answer to your question, but that's where my mind kind of has taken me.
I think it is. But I also think it raises real questions about how Native peoples get their voices heard in these conversations. I mean, some of the things that you're talking about, again, are ideas of practical first impression for me. I'm not hearing other people talk about these things. I'm not hearing members of Congress talking about these things, for instance. I can't remember the last time we had a president who talked seriously about some of the things that you're talking about. The Supreme Court, every once in a while, has an important ruling, I think, on Native matters, and there are actually some justices who have real experience in this area as well. But how do we get to the space where people think of this alongside civil rights for African Americans or Latinos or other people of color?
Well, we have to work at it. And one of the ways we work at it is by refashioning our kind of received understandings. And I always think having Native voices present works. And so I encourage local educators and community institutions to partner as best they can with the tribal community. And you'll often find yourself surprisingly drawn into new practices and understandings, as I was when I was 19 and 20 in Canada in the aftermath of this political crisis known as the Mohawk crisis of 1990. And Canada, as you may know, isn't that far from Detroit. you might be able to see it from your window. And you know, they've had a Truth and Reconciliation Commission. They had a parliamentary kind of established national tribunal on Indigenous affairs. There are kind of Aboriginal television stations across northern Canada that are in Inuit or in Cree. And the Mohawk community that I mentioned earlier has its own language program. Many, many things occur in these other jurisdictions that are worth perhaps learning about.
Yeah. I also want to talk about the subject of reparations. I wonder what you make of the efforts that have been made by the United States to some extent to try to repair the damage done to Native peoples, and I guess what more people might want to consider in terms of what's possible.
That's a great kind of question, because there have been efforts within the federal and congressional world to establish legislative statutes for these purposes. They're not that well known because most of these subjects aren't well understood. Mm-hmm. But there is a federal law called NAGPRA that was established in 1990, is mainly about graves and funerary protection of Native American burial sites, which have often been looted for by both institutional and individuals in American history. But it led to the establishment of a series of measures to return cultural objects of cultural patrimony to tribal communities. And so if you're a federally receiving institution, which, you know, most research and academic institutions are, you have to comply by these findings. And so it has bred this kind of really interesting and elaborate kind of mechanism for American Indian communities to regain objects of cultural patrimony, not just objects of funerary objects or burial remains themselves. So there can be ways of reforming these practices. Tribal communities, as you likely know, are also trying to get lands returned to them.
Yes.
So the land movement is a kind of a parallel or kind of congruent initiative around other forms of reparations. What I would say is that efforts for communal power have been achieved relatively successfully within Native American communities in ways that people don't fully understand. the book kind of concludes with some of those efforts. And there is kind of a kind of not necessarily a blueprint, but there are insights that can be gained from looking into these subjects.
Okay. Ned Blackhawk, professor of history at Yale University and author of The Rediscovery of America, Native Peoples, and the Unmaking of U.S. History. Really great to have you back here in Detroit to talk about your work and your journey, and especially great to have you here with us on Created Equal. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
That'll do it for this episode of Created Equal. Created Equal is produced by Carrie Jr. II and David Lines. Additional production support comes from Jack Philbrant. Audio editing is by Connor Anderson, and the music is by Sam Bobian. Our program director is Adam Foxon.